Hi, this is Anne Merchant, and welcome to The Sounds of Science, the podcast brought to you by the National Academy of Sciences, the National Academy of Engineering, the Institute of Medicine, and the National Research Council, collectively known as the National Academies. I've spent a lot of years thinking about pandemic flu. I don't have an unnatural obsession or anything, and I'm not especially paranoid, but in the course of my job here at the National Academies, I've had to read a number of reports from the Institute of Medicine, and so I'm fairly sensitive to talk of infectious diseases. Back in 1992, when the IOM released a study called simply Emerging Infections, I was introduced to the ways in which disease-causing microbes have threatened human health for centuries. As history, it's an interesting retrospective on infectious disease, but it also comes with a prediction for the future, namely that the threats we've experienced thus far will only intensify in the coming years. Then came the release of Microbial Threats to Health, a report that looked specifically at influenza, and which made it clear that most experts were not so much worried about whether a pandemic was coming, but when, given that they believe that the world stands on the verge of an influenza pandemic. The factors that underlie the emergence of all infectious diseases are expanding in magnitude and converging at an ever more rapid pace, increasing individual and societal vulnerability to infection. So when we consider how a flu virus emerges and spreads, we have to think about all sorts of interrelated things like the evolutionary potential of the virus itself, human susceptibility to the infection, the impact that climate and weather patterns can have on the transmission of disease, international travel and commerce patterns, global trends in poverty and social inequity, and all the dangers of complacency toward the threat of infectious diseases that have become somewhat entrenched in developed countries. Today, there's a new strain of influenza spreading across the globe. As Dr. Richard Besser, acting director of the Center for Disease Control and Prevention, said during a recent press conference,
people are concerned and we're concerned. And concern is a good thing. Concern is especially good if it drives planning and it drives action. And that's what we're encouraging people to do.
And so I pulled another IOM book off the shelf. This one, The Threat of Pandemic Influenza. Are We Ready? Was a report that looked at past 20th century pandemics, especially the ones from 1918, 1957, and 1968, all of which offer lessons for the future. In the early 20th century, science was sufficiently sophisticated to anticipate that influenza, which had twice reached pandemic proportions in the late 19th century, would recur, but was largely powerless to blunt the devastating impact of the 1918 H1N1 pandemic. Since then, we've gained ground and have significant advantages working in our favor. World Health Organization Director General Dr. Margaret Chan explains,
the world is better prepared for an influenza pandemic than at any time in history. Preparedness measures undertaken because of the threat from H5N1 avian influenza were an investment, and we are now benefiting from this investment.
We know more about influenza viruses in general. We have the capacity to design and manufacture vaccines and antiviral drugs to forestall, if not prevent, infection. And there's the promise of molecular technology that may one day help us identify even more effective treatments. But as the last month's events have now made very clear, the world remains vulnerable to the next pandemic, perhaps even more than in 1918, when the pace and frequency of global travel was considerably less than today. Studying past outbreaks gives us the perspectives we need to confront future microbial threats. The 1918-1919 influenza pandemic killed more people in absolute numbers than any other disease outbreak in history. A contemporary estimate puts the death toll at 21 million, a figure that persists in the media today but understates the real number. Epidemiologists and scientists have revised that figure several times since then. Each and every revision has been upward. A 2002 epidemiologic study estimates the deaths at between 50 and 100 million. Adjusting for population increases, a comparable toll today would be 175 to 350 million. The pandemic in 1918 was hardly the first influenza pandemic, nor was it the only lethal one. But 1918 seems to have been particularly violent. It began mildly, with a spring wave. In fact, it was so mild that some physicians wonder if this disease actually was influenza. When a second pandemic wave swept around the world, it also initially caused investigators to doubt that the disease was influenza, but this time because it was so virulent. It was followed by a third wave in 1919, and significant disease also struck in 1920. The 1918 virus, especially in its second wave, was not only virulent and lethal, but extraordinarily violent. It created a range of symptoms rarely seen with the disease. Symptoms were so unusual that initially influenza was misdiagnosed as dengue, cholera, or typhoid. The case mortality rate varied widely. An overall figure is impossible to obtain or even estimate reliably because no solid information about total cases exists. In U.S. Army camps where reasonably reliable statistics were kept, case mortality often exceeded 5%, and in some circumstances exceeded 10%. In the British Army in India, case mortality rate for white troops was 9.6%, but for Indian troops was 21.9%. In isolated human populations, the virus killed at even higher rates. In the Fiji Islands, it killed 14% of the entire population in 16 days. In Labrador and Alaska, it killed at least one-third of the entire native population. But perhaps most disturbing and most relevant for today is the fact that a significant minority of deaths came from the virus. Most people died from the secondary bacterial pneumonias they contracted. Today, we would call this atypical pneumonia acute respiratory distress syndrome, or ARDS. And the fact that ARDS likely caused more than half the deaths among young adults sends a warning. ARDS mortality rates today range from 40 to 60%, even with support in modern intensive care units. In a pandemic, ICUs would become quickly overwhelmed, representing a major challenge for public health planners. Physicians in 1918 tried everything they knew, everything that they had heard of, from the ancient art of bleeding patients to administering oxygen to developing new vaccines. Only one therapeutic measure, transfusing blood from recovered patients to new victims, showed any hint of success. Meanwhile, the public used home remedies of every description. None showed any evidence of effect. Some non-medical interventions did succeed. Total isolation, cutting a community off from the outside world, did work if done early enough. Gunnison, Colorado, a town that was a rail center and was large enough to have a college, succeeded in isolating itself. So did Fairbanks, Alaska. American Samoa escaped without a single case, while a few miles away in Western Samoa, 22% of the entire population died. Even if isolation only slowed the virus, it had some value. One of the more interesting epidemiologic findings in 1918 was that the later in the second wave someone got sick, the less likely he or she was to die, and the more mild the illness was likely to be. One hypothesis, although entirely speculative, is that at the peak of the pandemic, the virus was mutating rapidly, virtually with each passage through humans, but that it was mutating toward a less lethal form. As Dr. Chan explains,
influenza viruses are notorious for their rapid mutation and unpredictable behavior. Influenza pandemics must be taken seriously precisely because of their capacity to spread rapidly to every country in the world.
Virtually every expert on influenza believes that another pandemic is nearly inevitable, that it will kill millions of people, and that it could kill tens of millions, and that a virus like 1918 might kill 100 million or more, and that it could cause social and economic disruption on a massive scale. Influenza viruses can change the world, but life must and will go on. As we monitor the progress of today's H1N1 virus, keep in mind that our best defense lies in monitoring and reporting mechanisms that guarantee that an outbreak of disease receives appropriate attention from decision makers and the public in time to avert major consequences. CDC's Dr. Richard Besser.
No single action that somebody takes, whether it be the government, a community, a family, or an individual, will halt this, but the combined actions that we all take together will reduce the impact on our communities and on our health. It's a shared responsibility. There are things that all of us can do, individuals, families, communities, and government.
My name is Anne Merchant, and you've been listening to The Sounds of Science, the podcast brought to you by the National Academies, advisors to the nation on science, engineering, and medicine. Be sure to visit us at our website at nationalacademies.org, where we have more than 3,000 books and publications available full text to read free online.